Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to pick up on a few subjects we touched on last week, starting with energy efficiency, also maple syrup production, and what the move last week by the Quebec syrup cartel means for Vermont sugar makers. We'll also meet the man who hosted the show in this time slot on WDEV for 16 years, Mark Johnson. And we'll finish the morning hearing about the organization that promotes the heritage of the Champlain Valley region from salmon to suffrage. But let's start with by introducing you to the director of Efficiency Vermont, Carol Weston. Carol, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question for Carol about the work of Efficiency Vermont, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Carol, first of all, when was Efficiency Vermont formed and for what reason?
Efficiency Vermont was formed back in 2000 by the state legislature, and it was a move to really consolidate the efficiency programs that were happening across the state by the different electric utilities and bring together those programs in one place so that all Vermonters had easy access to the same program, regardless of where they lived and what utility they were a part of. And so we began a couple of decades ago offering electric efficiency services to Vermonters, and then in 2008 began also offering thermal efficiency services to Vermonters so they could save money on their electric use but also their fuel use.
So give us an overview of the services that you offer today.
Absolutely. So I want to note first that, you know, we are statewide and we serve every county and every town and city except for the city of Burlington, because Burlington Electric Department maintains its own efficiency program. And we partner very closely with our other fellow efficiency utility, Vermont Gas, which offers thermal efficiency services for its customers. So basically, we provide value to Vermonters in working with them because we can connect them with resources that help them understand their energy use and make changes that save money and energy. And so in their home, it might mean improving through weatherization, upgrading their appliances, thinking about how and when they're using energy, and talking with our support specialists and our engineers about how to make changes. And then in businesses, we can work directly with business owners and facility managers to help reduce energy bills by understanding, again, how they use energy, what type of equipment they use, and how they might be able to upgrade it or modify the way they use it to save money.
And Carol, who is eligible to receive these services?
Everyone in Vermont is eligible to receive the services of Efficiency Vermont, again, with the exception of the city of Burlington, who can work with Burlington Electric Department to receive them. So if you are a renter or a homeowner or a business owner and you have questions and you want to learn a little bit more about Efficiency Vermont, you can visit us at efficiencyvermont.com or you can call our customer support line.
All right. And what are the most important things people can do to make their home more energy efficient?
Great question. So as you know, we're heading into winter, or we're actually here already. You know, some of the things we notice when winter comes is that it's getting a little bit darker and it's getting much colder. And so some of the first things we notice are we need to turn on our lights more often and we are turning on our heat. So some of the biggest things you can do is to figure out if there are areas in your home where there are leaks, where cold air is coming in, and then take some steps to maybe seal those up. Potentially think about weatherizing your home, adding insulation, adding air sealing around windows, doors, and other areas of your home. And then when it comes to, you know, using your lights and appliances, making sure that you've got access to the most efficient ones. So looking for the Energy Star label whenever you buy appliances or light bulbs. Those are great ways to begin thinking about saving energy in your home.
On average, Carol, how much do you save households that you work with over a typical year?
Well, it certainly depends on what they're doing. But, you know, depending on, let's say someone, you know, weatherizes their home and they add insulation and air sealing, they can save, you know, potentially up to $800 a year on fuel, depending on the type of fuel they use, on the price of the fuel. And it really tends to pay for itself over time. So when you're installing something like weatherization in your home, that will last, you know, 20 years. And so you're providing that savings year over year, and it begins to really offer you options of what to do differently with the money that you are spending on heating. Another thing a lot of people are starting to do now, Rick, is thinking about cooling and air conditioning in their home. And, you know, it's starting to get quite warm in the summer, and we know that that's an issue for a lot of people. There are a couple of different things I'd like to sort of remind people about when it comes to cooling. You can look for a very efficient air window unit if that's what you want to do. And there are many efficient air conditioning units that are ENERGY STAR qualified, and I would encourage you to look for that. You also might want to consider installing a cold climate heat pump, which can provide you with cooling in the summer and provide heating in the shoulder seasons of winter and boost the work that your furnace is doing. So you don't have to turn your furnace on quite as early. It helps to reduce the cost they're spending on fossil fuel. And the prices of fossil fuel are going up, as we know, this year.
And I know Vermonters love to hold off turning on that furnace for as long as they possibly can into the fall.
Yes.
or even winter. It's almost like a dare, you know. You mentioned things like insulation, installing a cold climate heat pump, and the amount it can save people each year. But I would imagine that also adds to the value of your home, the resale value, when you go to sell it.
Absolutely. You know, if you're looking at a home or you're moving, you know, into a new apartment, when you go in there, you want to look for things that are going to help bring down the cost of you living there. And so if you see a cold climate heat pump, or you know that that home has been weatherized, or you see that those appliances are ENERGY STAR certified, you know that that home is going to be operating more efficiently than one that doesn't include those appliances and the weatherization work. So that can absolutely be a benefit to folks as they're thinking about selling their home.
Now, Carol, we've focused on the savings. There is cost to do this up front. So what kind of investment do people have to make up front to realize these efficiency savings?
Great question. And, you know, the first thing I want to make folks aware of is that starting small is totally fine. You know, you might decide, oh, I've not done anything. Maybe there's a lot to do. I don't even know where to start. Give us a call at Efficiency Vermont. Our customer support team has lots of experience working with folks. They can talk you through your energy bills, figure out where you're using energy and why, and then discuss with you the different options for ways that you can start. And you can start really simply with something that's free or very low cost. For example, Efficiency Vermont, through the end of this year, is offering free efficiency kits to all Vermonters. You can go on our website and sign up, and you'll receive an efficiency kit in the mail, which will include 6 light bulbs and a couple of water-saving devices that you can install. And that's a free way of just getting started. You know, but then if you start moving up and you've made a couple of improvements and you're thinking, I want to do something else, maybe you decide to look at the appliance that's costing you the most money. You have a very old refrigerator, or, you know, your clothes washer is old and you need to replace it anyway. Make sure you're looking for the ENERGY STAR appliance. So then we're starting to move up in cost, right? And so the payback of that measure that you're installing needs to really make sense to you. And so where Efficiency Vermont comes in is we can help you look at those different options. We can also provide you with a rebate or an incentive to bring down the cost of that equipment so you're paying less for it and you can install it in your home.
All right. Let's move to electric vehicles. So this is another area that I know Efficiency Vermont is very much excited about. How much can people save when they switch to an electric vehicle?
Well, electric vehicles are a great option for many folks, and we're seeing quite a bit of uptake, as you know. And so when you move to an electric vehicle, there's a few things that immediately fall off your payment list. The first is gasoline, obviously. You're not paying to fill your tank anymore. And the cost of charging your vehicle is much, much less than the cost of gasoline, on the order of, say, $1 a gallon or you know, right around $1 a gallon, as opposed to what we're paying now, $3 a gallon, maybe even going up. In addition to that, you will be saving money on maintenance for your vehicle. So because there's not a combustion engine inside this vehicle, they don't need a lot of the required maintenance that you would normally see. in a typical car. And so while you'll need tires, you know, and you'll need to, you know, replace your windshield fluid and all of that sort of thing, you're not going to have a lot of that major maintenance that you're, that you would have with a standard vehicle. So those are some of the ways. And then there's also rebates available to Vermonters who are switching to electric vehicles. So the state offers a rebate, and you can get rebates from your utility on getting an electric vehicle. And you can also get rebates on car chargers so that you've got the equipment in your home to plug your vehicle in. So again, over the course of many years, this vehicle will pay for itself, and you'll be able to really understand the benefits of having an electric vehicle in your home.
Darn it, Carol, I'm going to really miss those oil changes every 3,000 miles.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. Now, Vermont has some really ambitious goals regarding the number of electric vehicles that we want on the road. So how are we going to get to those goals?
Great question. Vermont does have very ambitious goals about around electric vehicles. And there are some, you know, real legitimate concerns that Vermonters have about electric vehicles. They want to know that it's safe, and they want to know that it's going to be able to do for them what their car is doing. And so what the exciting thing that's happening right now is that Vermont is really invested in getting electric vehicles installed in our homes and enabling us to use them at the same time that electric vehicle technology is really advancing. So there's a lot more model types that are coming out that have all-wheel drive, which we know in Vermont can be really important. There are trucks that are coming onto the market. There are, you know, compact cars if you live in a place where you don't have, you know, a great place to park. You know, so there's a lot happening in the market where new vehicles are coming on. And so as Vermont begins to up the incentives that we're offering people, and Efficiency Vermont gets involved in really helping people understand what an electric vehicle can do and what's, you know, what's the right type of vehicle for you, people are going to find that there are more cars to choose from. And that's going to be a great sort of perfect storm, if you will, of the technology and the opportunity coming together for folks.
And that's one side of the equation, Carol. What about charging stations? Are there enough? Are there enough planned to make these vehicles viable in Vermont?
There are quite a few charging stations in Vermont now, but there are definitely we're going to need more for mass adoption of these vehicles.
Right.
The state of Vermont is really invested in that, and they've defined some direct corridors within both along the interstate routes in Vermont and also on some of the major roads in Vermont, where they will have charging stations within certain distances of exits and certain, you know, distances on road corridors like Route 7, so that people can feel really confident that they can drive wherever they need to go and find a fast charger that can quickly charge their car up for them. So you'll see some now as you move around the state, but over the next 3 to 4 years, the state of Vermont is really going to be investing in more charging infrastructure, and that's going to make a big difference for people as well when they think about, you know, do I have enough car battery to get to where I go? So that range anxiety will start to come down. It will also start to feel more normal. Folks will understand how to use a car charger. It will just become a little bit more normalized for us.
We're spending this segment discussing what you can do to make your home more energy efficient, where you can find help to attain that. With me is Carol Weston, Director of Efficiency Vermont. To speak with Carol, you can call us at 802-244-1777 and 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's go to the phones, and we've got Peggy joining us from South Royalton. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning. I was calling because I had recently received a letter from Energy Efficiency Vermont saying that they would be willing to come out and do sort of a free energy audit type of thing for my business. And so when I finally got around to calling and asking if we could do this, the comment that I got was, well, it's better if you just call your local electrician. And I was very disappointed by that, to be offered a service and then say, well, call your local electrician, my local electrician is extremely busy. So I just wanted to make that comment. I certainly support Energy Vermont's goals, but I was very disappointed at that service that was offered to me but not offered to me.
What was it you were asking Efficiency Vermont to do, Peggy?
I have a dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so having them come out and give me suggestions is what I could do to make – especially the lighting, more energy efficient.
Sure.
And then that was the comment. Well, it's since we don't promote certain products, it's just better if you call your electrician. So that I found disappointing.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Peggy, for calling and giving us that feedback. It's so helpful to get that sort of feedback. You know, it certainly sounds like you have additional questions that we may be able to help you answer. And we do, in fact, do visits at farms and in businesses. I would love to understand a little bit more about, you know, exactly what your questions are and what you'd like to do. We can probably talk about that offline. But generally, when a person calls in to our customer support line, they try to do their best to understand what's going on in the business. And it's very possible that there was just, you know, not enough questions that got asked, or maybe they just didn't have the right information in the moment. That does happen. You know, sometimes that happens. But I want to make sure that you were able to get the service that you need. I do want to just take a slight tangent and say you're right about contractors being very busy right now, and that it is a very busy time for them, and it's a tough time. So I can understand, you know, that your contractor isn't available to come out, and we would love to be able to support you more. So what I would encourage you to do, Peggy, is to give us a call again, even send me an email. I'll be happy to give you my email address, and I can work with you to make sure that you get that problem addressed. Thank you.
What number can Peggy call, Carol?
So Peggy can call 888-921-5990.
All right, Peggy, do you have that?
I do.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for your call. All right, let's go now to Woodbury, talk to Goddard. Hi, Goddard. Go right ahead.
Good morning, friends. Thanks for this program.
Sure.
I don't want to bring down the guest, because, you know, we're all for efficiency the way we're all for virtue against sin. However, in the real world we've come to know and love, I have been first confused and then frustrated in the past 13 years in attempting to avail myself of services. I don't have a dairy or a dairy farm like the previous caller, but I am a retired person living in the country and with an over 20-year experience of building and remodeling houses. So I know which end of the hammer to hold. One of the things that troubles me very much as I've tried to work with some weatherization services, which in this area are mediated through Capstone, is you have to work through what I would call, perhaps cynically, the old boy network, that is to say, approved contractors. And that is a very small group. I think this is a bottleneck both for scheduling and, frankly, it's discriminatory against people who might be able, just with a little bit of help, to get the work done without dealing with the old boy network. I would also second Peggy's comment about the long lead time. As a person of faith, I believe I pray every day for the second coming, but I think that might happen before some of these services are available. That being said, keep up the good work. But I'd be interested to hear your guest comment on the fact that basically the pool of approved talent is very, very shallow.
All right, Goddard, thanks for those comments. Carol, I guess a couple questions there. First of all, the approved contractors, you know, why that's done, you know, who gets approved. And then if you do an audit for someone, do they have to use an approved contractor to do the work? Or, you know, how do you address what Goddard's problems are or concerns are?
Sure. Great question. So let me just talk a little bit about the weatherization program. There's a broad network of organizations that are working on weatherization across the state, as you know, and Goddard reflected upon the weatherization agencies that provide comprehensive weatherization services to income-qualified Vermonters. So that's certainly one way where folks can get their home weatherized. And you're right that there's a limited amount of people and a limited amount of bandwidth to install weatherization for the many folks that are eligible. And that is something that we work that we work to resolve in many ways, adding capacity, working with those agencies to think about different ways that we can make our program a little bit easier and quicker. However, you're right, there are a limited number of contractors there. The weatherization program that Efficiency Vermont supports is similar in that we offer services through qualified contractors. And the reason that we do that is that weatherizing a home is a really technical endeavor. So you want to make sure when you air seal your home and you insulate it, that you're also allowing ventilation to occur, because what you don't want to do is seal up your home so tightly that your indoor air quality becomes an issue, and you don't want mold to happen and things of that sort. So it's really important that the qualified contractor understands building science, and that's why we and the weatherization agencies both lean on qualified contractors to do that work. So it's a safety and a health issue. And to your point, Goddard, for sure, we know that there's a workforce shortage in Vermont. And one of the things that Efficiency Vermont does in its role as the statewide implementer is we work with contractors very closely. We work with the Vermont Technical College and local high school technical programs to think about ways to engage students and engage people to move into the weatherization workforce. And growing that workforce is going to be a very key component to weatherizing more homes in Vermont. We talked earlier about growing the electric vehicle fleet in Vermont. We also want to get more homes weatherized. That's what the Climate Action Plan calls for. That's what's in the Comprehensive Energy Plan. It's what we all support, as you said, Goddard. And so we want to do everything we can to support the state's efforts to grow the workforce. And one of the ways we do that is by providing training and connecting new people in the workforce to contractors who are looking for help.
Carol, we have about a minute left. We got this email from RC who asks, what do we know about recycling the batteries from electric vehicles? What will be done with them after they've outlived their usefulness?
Yep, great question, right? So with every technology comes another problem to solve, and this is one of them. So the good news about car batteries is that they last a lot longer than they used to. So where they used to just last a few years, now they're lasting 15 years, so they last as long as the car will. Mm-hmm. Certainly, proper disposal of them is going to be very important, and that's information that we can provide to folks if they want to go to our website, give us a call. You know, you won't have to recycle your car battery, but if you want to understand what happens to it, feel free to call us, and we'd be happy to talk through that with you. But you're right, it's something that we always need to consider with new technology.
All right, and RC, that number to call is 888-921-5990. Carol Weston is the director of Efficiency Vermont. To learn more about what they do, .com. Carol, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time, and thanks to your callers as well.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to chat with Mark Isselhart, which pretty much means it's time to turn your attention to the sugar bush of yours.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Ron Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. We unofficially got the maple syrup season started last week, and we spoke with a representative of the Quebec maple syrup producers to discuss the release of half of their stored syrup reserves. Alas, a bad phone line limited us to half of the allotted time for the interview. On the positive side, it allows us to turn to Mark Isselhart for a further explanation of the syrup cartel, what the move last week means for Vermont sugar makers, and several other maple-related issues. Joining us now is Mark Isselhart. He's host of the Vermont Maple Minute, and he's UVM Extension Maple Specialist. Mark, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. Now, listeners, if you've got a question for Mark about maple sugaring, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Mark, bring us up to speed again. What is this Quebec Maple Syrup Producers Strategic Reserve?
Yeah, it is a different way of organizing the industry up there for sure. The one important thing to remember is how large the province of Quebec is in terms of production. They produce over 70% of all the syrup made every year in the world. And in 1990, actually, they started organizing in a way to kind of manage supply. It took a while for things to really kick in, and in the year 2000. One of those marketing tools was the strategic reserve of syrup. And anyone who's ever tapped a tree knows that syrup and sapolo is not predictable, and it's not even from year to year. Some years are good, some years are not as good, although technology can help mitigate that. But it was realized that having a buffer for years where production didn't meet targets or expectations was going to be really important for growing the industry. As you can imagine, if you do all the hard work of marketing syrup and sell it to some large account, and then you come back and say, well, the next year the price is going to be up by 50% because we had a poor year, those accounts don't stick around very long. So the two main goals of that strategic reserve were make consistent supply from year to year and then to stabilize prices.
And how do they accomplish that, Mark?
Well, the constant supply is that, luckily we've seen yields going up every year, and that's adoption of good technology, careful leak checking, just best practices in general, tapping into good clean wood rather than stained wood. And so we've seen yields go up, and in those years they can put some of the excess production that isn't already spoken for sales into a reserve. Maple syrup, assuming it's well heated and put into clean containers, large drums, it's fairly stable. And so they build the supply, and then as needed, they can release it. The other stable prices aspect is really a function of their market share. Having over 70% of all the crop, they are essentially able to set a price that's good for their producers. It is a producer-based organization, and they can make sure their producers are able to make a living and go forward. The price is set in Canadian dollars, and so the biggest impact for U.S. producers, or really anyone outside of that organization in the province of Quebec, it's highly tied to the exchange rate with the Canadian dollar.
Now, a few weeks ago, they released a large amount, and I believe they also released more last week. Is that right, Mark?
Right. Yeah, the initial release was 70 million pounds, 50 million pounds, which works out to be a little more than 6 million gallons, which is more than three times the annual crop for Vermont. So we're really talking pretty big numbers here. I recently spoke with one of the directors that organization, and they said that they actually are releasing an additional 20 million pounds, so that brings it up to 70. I would say the biggest reason they're doing this is because there's been such demand. The estimates are 20-21% increase in demand for syrup, kind of coinciding with the pandemic. So people are cooking more at home. They're not eating out at breakfast-type places or other places where syrup would have been available. And, of course, it's anyone's guess moving forward, but it appears that there are some new consumers out there globally. The United Kingdom, Germany, Australia, Japan, those are all pretty big consumers of maple syrup, U.S. being by far the biggest importer of Canadian syrup.
All right. We're happy about that, the increase in the use of maple syrup. How does what they're doing, holding these reserves and then releasing it, how does that help or hinder Vermont sugar makers?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly several ways to look at it, and I don't want to, you know, my opinion, you know, there's people who have all sorts of opinions. I think what can be said is that they put more money, given the way they're organized, they're able to put more money towards marketing maple syrup globally and making consumers that previously unaware of what maple was aware of maple syrup. Of course, they're not, they're doing some generic marketing, but for the most part, it has a Canadian maple leaf on it. But I think that helps the entire industry. I think the idea that that Quebec is somehow flooding the market with syrup, I don't think they're necessarily doing that given the growth and demand. And we've seen that demand in the U.S. and in Vermont specifically. So I think producers here would recognize an increase in sales if they're set up to take advantage of that demand. So either online marketing, or if they have a family member or someone in other parts of the country where pure maple isn't as available, we're hearing reports of really robust sales and demand for this product. I think the biggest thing to remember is that all the maple syrup, Quebec, Vermont, everywhere else, it represents about maybe 2% of all the syrup, you know, table syrup, corn syrup in the world. And I think the biggest competitor is probably that, trying to take a little bit more out of that corn syrup fake product market share. And it appears that that is taking hold of it.
I made a face when you talked about the fake syrups. Now, Mark, how long you talked about this being stable when they put it in these drums. How long can they keep syrup stored in the reserves? Does it need to be refrigerated?
It is. Yep, they do have it in climate-controlled areas. I would probably defer to them to say exactly how long they hold it, but they certainly can pasteurize it like all good producers would at a critical temperature in a clean container. They can hold it for several years, and it won't degrade to the point where it's no longer you know, grade A pure maple syrup.
All right. Now, the supply management idea, this system that goes on in Quebec, is it needed here in Vermont, or would it ever gain any traction?
Well, again, that's probably a matter of personal taste for that type of organization. I know the Sugar Makers Association in Vermont has looked at that several times over the years that I've been involved in maple and before. And I think there are periods where there's interest, and then when you look at the logistics, it becomes difficult. You know, a market order like you see in beef or milk and other agricultural commodities essentially requires a certain contribution on the producer side towards this organization. Maple, usually the larger the pot of money you end up with, it depends on how many producers are involved in the first place. But the more producers and states involved, the less of a voice your particular state has. And so I think that's where some of the tension has come, and sort of those drives have fizzled out. And that if you want to have a Vermont-only market order, the pot of money, although we're quite large in the U.S., it's still relatively large for making significant marketing efforts and promotion globally. Marketing just takes so much money to have an impact. So I won't say it'll never happen, but there have been plenty of opportunities and ever totally taken root.
All right. Mark Iselhart is with me until 10. We're discussing all things maple syrup. After the break, we're going to talk about this week's Maple Conference. Listeners, to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. 8255. You can also email VTViewpoint at radiovermont.com. Mark Isselhard hosts the Vermont Maple Minute, and he also joins the show to discuss the most recent issues regarding sugaring. This morning, we're chatting about the Quebec maple syrup reserves and a few other issues. To ask Mark about it, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Mark, this is a big week for you. The Vermont Maple Conference Week is this week, going on Wednesday through Friday. So tell us what happens at the conference.
Right. Thanks, Rick. So the Vermont Maple Conference is a long-running partnership between UVM Extension and the Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association. And we host a variety of live presentations, everything from good forest management, sugar maple health, all the way through optimizing your high yields of sap production, careful grading and quality management of the finished product, marketing, and for folks who have never tapped a tree and want to learn how to do it. So we have a real variety. Unfortunately, with COVID being the way it is, we had to cancel our in-person event, but we're sticking with our online conference, and we're going to have 3 days. It's December 8th, 9th, and 10th, and there are three sessions per day. And probably the best thing to know is it's free. We're eliminating any registration fees, and you can log on to see all nine of those sessions if you're interested. The registration is handled through the Sugar Makers Association website. So if people go to Vermont Maple, it's all one word, .org, and search for Maple Conferences, you'll see a link to registration. All kinds of topics, food safety, an update from the Proctor Maple Research Center, all kinds of things.
Who can attend, Mark? Who should attend the conference this week?
Well, it's open to everyone. And one thing we learned about the past 18, 20 months is that people got into maple. A lot of folks who had never tapped a tree before found themselves with some time in the spring and decided to get into it. We heard about very robust sales in the small-scale sugaring sector, and so we're excited to provide some more information and to bring those folks on to make sure they're making the best quality product and following that really proud tradition of Vermont maple. So anyone can join. There's no limitation. We encourage people to spread the word, and the way it's set up is there are one-hour sessions on each of those 3 days. One is at 9 o'clock, one's at noon, and one's at 5. And each of those time slots is different topic. So you can see the whole schedule. You go to that VermontMaple.org page, and you can pick and choose what you want. And we kick the whole thing off with an industry panel discussion, which would be a much deeper dive than we're talking about today, about the Quebec Reserve and where things are going into the future as far as marketing, but also topics related to forestry and the tree side of maple, which is a huge part.
Yeah. You mentioned a lot more people have tried their hand at it. If someone wants to begin sugaring, what is the best way to learn how to get into, even on a small scale to begin with?
Yeah, I think probably reaching out to either someone in your neighborhood who does it already, or there is the you can certainly reach out to me directly. I'm happy to share resources I have for beginning sugar makers. Basically, if you live in Vermont, you either know or nearby someone who makes maple syrup. So sugar makers are very generous with their time and willing to share expertise. Everyone's gone through the process, it seems like. You start small and then you catch the bug and it grows and grows, and a lot of innovation and a lot of trial and error, and some of it can be avoided by just using good sources of information. And there's a lot on the internet you can learn, but I am somewhat cautious about sending people just blindly to type in how to tap a tree, because there's some pretty bad information out there.
All right. And again, let's give people the information for the Vermont Maple Conference. It is this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. There will be talks at 9, noon, and 5 each day. And you can go to vermontmaple.org to register, see the schedule, and enjoy that. Mark, you're part of UVM Extension, which I've always thought of, you know, as farming. So is maple sugaring, is sugar making a form of farming?
Yeah, well, I mean, before I answer, I'll say that Extension is a very broad organization, everything from 4-H to business management, engineering, and agricultural engineering. Hugely diverse organization, but my little part of it is on maple. Mm-hmm. And maple is this odd combination of forest management and food production and agriculture. It's a little bit of everything. Historically, it certainly was an outgrowth of farm activity. It was something that farmers could do when there wasn't other opportunities in the field. But the industry has evolved over time, and we have people who don't come from a farming background are just jumping in because of the love of the product and the work involved. So, you know, it's a bit of everything, but it certainly has agricultural roots and is certainly an agricultural product in a lot of ways.
What can people what can they be doing at this time of year to prep for sap season?
Well, depending on the size of the operation, folks are out there probably not too long starting to tap. When you have very large operations, you need to do that in order to be ready for when the sap flows in 2022. The vast majority of producers are not that big, and so they're out there probably checking their lines, making sure that any wind damage has been repaired before those lines get frozen underneath a layer of ice and snow. You know, any kind of other maintenance issues that can be done before the heavy snowpack arrives. Tapping a lot of times for many producers means snowshoes and anything you can do before you have to put on snowshoes and be on top of feet and feet of snow is usually appreciated from the person doing that work.
Can we tell anything from this year's weather about how the upcoming sugar season will be, or is it all dependent on, you know, how many of those perfect condition nights we have, you know, below freezing at night, going up, you know, to about 40 during the day?
Yeah, it's really hard to predict. You can have factors that might nudge the season to come in one way or the other, but those can be swamped pretty easily by having good weather or not good weather during that 6 to 8 week period of sap flow. So in other words, if you have a prolonged period of dry weather in the growing season before, it generally will, it appears to have an impact on lowering the sap sweetness, but not always. And even that difference can be kind of wiped out by having a really good, robust sap flow season and good moisture during the actual harvest season. So there's lots of biological factors. It's very complex and hard to research, but we know the biggest driver is that weather and not getting too warm too. That's those really high temperature events like we saw back in 2012, where we had 5 days in the 70s in March. That's the kind of thing that really can keep folks up at night if you're in the business of harvesting sap, because not only does the quality of sap go down relatively quickly, but the tap holes themselves become less and less productive when you have those really extreme warmth temperatures.
Do we have an idea of how many syrup makers we do have here in Vermont?
Well, you know, we don't have great data. We have some. We think it's, you know, perhaps 2,000, maybe up as high as 3,000, depending on how many of small operations you're counting. I'm part of a committee through an international maple organization trying to improve the census and the survey of maple producers. It's part of the USDA, and we recognize that it's an undercounting of what's actually happening. So we're trying to improve the survey, make it easier and less cumbersome for producers to fill out. And we're also trying to spread the word and let them know, if you're not on the list, this is the National Ag Statistics Service. If you're not on the list, then you won't get the survey and you won't be counted. It is important for folks to know that this USDA agency is not allowed to share that information with any other agency, and sometimes that can help boost interest in this activity.
Gotcha. Mark Isselhardt is a UVM Extension Maple Specialist. He's the host of the Vermont Maple Minute. And, Mark, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Yep, all right. Take care.
Take care. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I've just marked a year of hosting Vermont Viewpoint, and I will admit that keeping these plates spinning and trying to book guests for 10 hours a week and prepare for those interviews makes one feel a bit like Sisyphus. And then I think about my next guest, who made it look easy for 16 years at WDEV, 25 years in total. Mark Johnson hosted the Mark Johnson Show for that long, and he's still held in the highest esteem among Vermont radio people and journalists. And he joins me now as a guest of the show he so adroitly hosted for all those years. Mark, welcome back to your time slot.
Well, the first year is a breeze, but it's really hard. But the next 24, Rick, will be a breeze. So
the first one's hard, then it gets easy for 24 more.
Totally.
Oh, all right. Ooh, yeah, putting my feet up. All right. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Mark a question or share an interview of his that you remember well, you can call us at 802-244-1777.
1-800-286-9537.
Oh, no, it's now 877-291-TALK.
Okay. All right.
But you got the first one right. Yeah. 877-291-8255. And vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Oh, that's funny, though, that you still remember it. So how long has it been?
Yeah.
It's been, what, 3-4 years? 5 years?
Yeah, more like 5 or 6, but yeah. Yeah, no, I'll remember those when I'm going down into the coffin.
The people, what's he mumbling? Oh, it's the number to call. Well, what led you to WDEV in the first place, Mark?
Ken Squire. I was part of a group along with Louis Mano and Jim Condon in 1990. We purchased a radio station in Burlington, which we ran together for 8 years. Had a great time. It was nothing like working with, you know, two of your best friends. It was a barrel of laughs every day. But it was, you know, it's a hard business, very competitive in the Burlington market. So I had known Ken and had done some work previously with DEV as a freelancer, and he approached us in the late 90s about purchasing our station. And he did, and then we had a business relationship, you know, for the next 16 years, as you pointed out.
Wow. Were you just doing the show at WDEV, or did you have other responsibilities here?
No, well, we were the owners, which meant that I did the billing every month. You know, Louis and Jim took care of other paperwork. You know, we all had a role to play as owners. You know, Louis would be selling advertising at 9:01 in the morning as soon as he got out the air. So we did everything. Nobody washed the dishes, but other than that, we did everything.
All right. So 25 years of that show. Do you remember who you had on your first day when it all got started?
Oof. No, actually, I don't. I had actually started a few years before. I filled in for Jack Berry for a number of years. He would go down to Florida every winter for a month, and I would fill in for his show then. And I'm pretty sure I had Madeline Kunin on. That was my first guest then.
Oh, wow.
She was actually the source of one of the great nightmares that I had in radio, which was at one point at WKDR, Peter Frayne and I were hosting an afternoon show, And we had forgotten that we were supposed to be doing actually out on a remote location. And Peter couldn't do the show that day, so it was just me. Madeline Cunin was supposed to be on. And I left a note for her on the door at WKDR, which, of course, blew off the door. And I wound up all alone at a restaurant out in Colchester until Gary Nelson, who I'm sure some of you out there know, was a UVM professor and a political science professor.
Oh, yeah, Garrison Nelson.
Recently on my show.
Yeah.
Lived around the corner and heard me scrambling a little bit and came down and joined me. I wound up having a great show. But no, I don't remember the first one at WKDR, to be truthful.
Isn't it fun, Mark, when something goes wrong and you don't have a guest, and now you have a half hour or an hour to fill with, and sometimes that's when the phones go down. Isn't that the most exciting thing about radio?
Well, it is. I mean, it is operating without a net.
Yes,
I mean, you really, truly never know, you know, what's going to happen at any moment. I mean, I was on the air when 9/11 happened, you know, which we all remember where we were that morning. But we had a little small TV in the studio at that point. I remember we turned it on, and I mean, it was, you know, and then the towers came down about an hour later. I mean, it's quite a way to communicate with people. I think really one of the things that's great about radio is that, you know, you really have to listen. There's nothing to distract you in terms of the visuals. And, you know, so much of TV is really about the visuals. So that's one of the things that I always appreciated and made it so you didn't have to put on a suit and tie every day, too, for that matter.
That's right. Yeah, we don't have to get too gussied up, and that makes things pretty great. Let's take a call. We've got Teresa joining us. Hi, Teresa.
Good morning. Just wanted to give a shout-out to Mark, saying we enjoyed his show for a good number of years. And, Rick, you were asking about a particular show that we remembered. And one of the things that I remembered about Mark was the show he did after the Shumlin election, when Shumlin came closer than he thought he was going to losing that election. I just remember the commentary that Mark had and the humility and thinking about not just in that story but in others when sometimes the reporters get it wrong or don't see it coming. And he was just very, very humble on that, but also really informative, so as he was in all of his shows. So just wanted to give a shout-out and say we enjoyed listening to you.
Thanks, Teresa. Great moment. That was Scott Milne almost upsetting the sitting governor who had run. He had won twice. I think that was his third election. And, boy, it came very close. Scott Milne also didn't kind of let that go. That went to the state legislature because the governor didn't have 50% of the vote. But then the legislature did vote in Governor Shumlin for that third term. But boy, what was it like that that morning when you woke up? You're like, whoa, zoinks, what happened here?
Yeah, that certainly was a lot closer than I think most people thought. I had actually forgotten that fun fact you mentioned, that Scott Mill took that to the legislature. Was there a third candidate? Who was the third candidate that year?
Oh, that's a good question. Wasn't Bill?
There must have been somebody that peeled off some votes there. Maybe that was the year. Well, maybe it was the year Polina ran. I remember he ran one year.
Oh, that could
but
be.
Yeah, and that was you know, Peter Shumlin's the things really started to unravel there. You'll recall that there was the story about his neighbor where people really thought he'd taken advantage of him.
Right, bought that piece of property.
For a song, and then, you know, the EB5 thing was really starting to, you know, we were starting to get our real first whiffs of a problem in that, too. So things really did sort of unravel for him.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the general election. All right, let's see. I can't find it that quickly. Let me try to get that, but let's go to Rich next in Starksboro. Hi, Rich. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Mark. Welcome back to the studio there. I just want to say that I always appreciated how you were very impartial and very polite and tactful to all your audiences. But what I remember most was when there was an important question you asked, you were asking someone and you were sensing the person was dodging the question, you appropriately persisted in a gentle way and did your very best to get the answer out of the person. And I really respected that. And I appreciate all the years you were there, and I never had a chance to thank you and wish you well. But anyway, after 6 years, thank you, and I wish you well.
Rich, that's a beautiful
thanks, Rich.
Call.
That's nice of you to say.
Yeah, and great sentiment, but also the point that Rich makes, that remaining neutral, you know, is probably the most difficult thing, you know, to not impose your beliefs, your thoughts, especially if it's something you're really passionate about. Mark, you know, talk about how you were able to do that for so long.
Well, I mean, not to be flip about it, but I mean, the truth, I always felt it's much more interesting to hear what the guest had to say. And, you know, that's why people were tuning in. I really didn't feel as though, I mean, in limited circumstances, I just didn't really feel as though people were that interested to know what Mark Johnson thinks about something. I think it was much more interesting, you know, to get interesting guests on the air, you know, important political figures, try to hold them accountable. You know, I had an awful lot of people from the media on the show, and I think really you listen to a lot of talk radio out there, and, you know, Rush Limbaugh is probably the poster child of it. I mean, 3 hours a day of you know, one person's opinions. He never had guests. He was also quite successful, but that just was not an approach that I was comfortable doing, and I really tried to make the show about the guest.
Yeah. All right, Mark, here's what the 2014 gubernatorial election was all about. Peter Shumlin won by about 2,500 votes, a percentage point over Scott Milne. Dan Feliciano, remember, ran as a Libertarian, got 8,400 votes, 4.3%. So that took,
wow.
Yeah, quite a chunk away, probably from Scott. And then Emily Payton was next. She garnered 3,100 votes in that election, 1.6%. That was a pretty good showing for her. So, that's really interesting looking back on how that played out that night.
Yeah, wow, that is, I mean, it was one percentage point. I mean, it was it was close, no question about it.
Dangerously. All right, we're celebrating WDEV at 90 by meeting many of the station's true all-stars. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I don't think I've done anything in my life for 25 years, let alone do it as well as Mark Johnson did hosting this show. As part of WDEV's 90th anniversary, we're hearing from the talented and hardworking individuals who have worked here through the years to keep you entertained and informed. To speak with Mark or share a special moment that you remember from his time here, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Back to the phones we go, and I got to ask this guy, Fred, were you calling in back in the Mark Johnson days as well?
Oh, what was I ever? You know, the interesting thing about it is there's two guys that were hosts on the show, and they have been the best by far, Mark and Dave. There was something
Dave
about
Graham.
Mark that could there's something about Mark that made the caller a part of the show. I mean, he made you feel good. I mean, I was addicted to the show, and I still am. But I'll have to say that Mark and Dave were just unbelievable guys. They knew what to do. They would talk about anything. They didn't worry about whatever you wanted to talk about. They would talk about it, and it was a lot of fun.
Wow, that's great to hear. Fred, thanks for that call. Mark, you remember Fred well?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. It was like a whole extended family, believe me.
Well, we've given Fred a title. He's now the Duke of Newbury, and I'm not sure. I think I made him mayor, and he said, well, I'm more like a duke, and so he has become the Duke of Newbury. I don't know how the folks
in
Newbury
are not, thinking. He's certainly not the most famous person now from Newbury, with Molly Gray announcing this morning she's going to run for Congress.
Oh, so true. That's right. Yep. He's down the he's B list celebrity over there in Newbury now. thanks to Molly. That's right. All right. So who were some of your favorite people to interview during your time?
Oh, boy. I would have to say I had a great collection of people that were regulars that were my lifelines. You know, people like Ross Sneed, who worked at the Associated Press. I mean, the guy was on just about every Monday during the legislative session, giving a preview for the week. You know, Eric Davis, who taught over at Middlebury, political scientist. Cheryl Hanna, longtime professor at the Vermont Law School. I mean, those kinds of people were just really kind of critical, I think, to my success.
Yeah.
I also had this great connection down in Washington. And I don't know if you folks remember Ellen Ratner, who was a White House correspondent and did reports for a number of talk radio stations. And she also went to Goddard College, so we had something of a connection there. And, you know, that opened me up to let me go down to the New Hampshire primaries, which I did every 4 years. Mm-hmm. Interviewed, you know, all the candidates doing that. I got the chance to go to China on a junket with Governor Jim Douglas. It was a trade trip, excuse me. And you know, right. I will tell you, I had one of the best interviews I've ever had. I thought with Big Cheese, Ken Squire, talking about his career and the 1979 call that he had at the Daytona 500, which the final lap where everybody was crashing and banging and Richard Petty winds up coming through the smoke to win the race. And, you know, it was just really one of the great all-time sports calls because it's spontaneous. I mean, you want to talk about not knowing what's going to happen. I mean, everybody's cruising along in the final lap and then you got, you know, three people in the wall. So, I will tell you, I had a great interview with my mom. I never interviewed my dad, which I greatly regret. And I was not going to miss the opportunity to interview Ken Squire. So I remember doing that. And that was a special broadcast, at least for me. And I hope for some other people too. But I was also fortunate. I had some great connections, some publicists nationwide who, David McCullough, the author of, books about Truman and Adams on.
Brilliant.
Seabiscuit author Laura Hillenbrand, who wrote that incredible book from her bed with chronic fatigue syndrome. I was very fortunate to find some really special people out there. And again, you know, make the show about them.
Yeah. I don't want to get you in any trouble, but we're – any that were particularly difficult to interview?
Not that come to mind. I mean, there were some politicians in Vermont that were, would answer yes or no. Mm-hmm. Were not terribly expansive.
Right.
I can't think of any particularly bad situations, but not that immediately come to mind.
After years of interviewing all those politicians, have you ever considered a run yourself for political office?
No, that will never happen. I don't have the interest in that.
Yeah.
You know, I watch the Burlington City Council meetings, for example. You know, God bless those people.
Right.
Sitting through 5-hour meetings and often in the face of great hostility.
Right.
I think I could find a better way to serve, and that just is not something that I will ever do.
Touche. Hey, let's go to Barry
next. I am not announcing my candidacy that I'm running for lieutenant governor this morning.
This would be the place, but you've turned it down. No problem. We got Jim and Barry up next. Go ahead, Jim. You're up.
Hi, good morning. Hey. Good morning, Mark. It's good to hear your voice again. I don't know when you actually started, but I started way back listening to you in the early days. A couple of calls of mine or a couple of situations come to mind. You were interviewing Ruth Dwyer. I remember exactly where I was sitting in traffic, and you were pressing her on the Take Back Vermont thing or the civil union things, and she really resisted answering it, and it was really kind of an interesting answer because she was kind of neutral about it, I thought, actually. But then you pressed her, and she ultimately said it wouldn't be something that I would be in favor of. And that took off and sank her candidacy, and it directly came from the Mark Johnson Show. Another one was Cheryl Hannah's death. It was the way you handled that was just very, very sensitive. And anyway, I remember that and remember calling like a year later because I reminded you of the it was the anniversary of it or something to that effect. But she was just such an amazing person, and you had some just incredibly heartfelt comments about her suicide. And the last thing was, and I'm quite certain it was you, you were interviewing Mike. The next guy was interviewing someone from the generator in Burlington, which is a makerspace. I'm quite certain it was you. And I called and asked about it. I'd never heard of it before and was very interested in having access to a shop like that. And he told me about, this was right on the air, told me about the foundry over in Lindenville that had started up at Linden Institute. And I ended up joining that and ultimately went on and built something that I got a patent on. And it all started from your show. I'm quite certain it was you. It might have been the next Mike took over. But anyway, so it was a terrific run, and I've been listening to DEV for 35 years, and you were a big part of that.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for that.
What a great story.
That is
Thanks
a great story. Mark, I'm going to give you the credit. It must have been you who got Jim up to Lindenville and got him that patent. So we're going to put that on your resume.
Why not?
So if you could come back and do one more show, you had 2 hours, and we've got 1 minute for this answer. But if you had 2 hours to fill, who would you have on with you?
Ooh, boy. I would just take calls, right? Isn't that the right answer?
Oh, yeah.
No, I think I would probably go back to one of the guys that I had on, who unfortunately has passed away, so I couldn't put him on your imaginary show, but one of the guys that I would love to bring back and have on the air again is there is a guy who's a wildlife conservationist who growing up had this terrible stutter. But when he went to the zoo, was able to talk to the animals. And he was ridiculed in school, couldn't even communicate with his teachers. And he wound up going on to become this world-renowned wildlife conservationist. That's the kind of guy I would love to do another interview with. You know, the politicians were great. I loved doing the show on Fridays at the legislature. That was a great time. But those other ones are the ones that really kind of stuck with me much more.
Oh, that's beautiful. Mark Johnson set the bar so very high as host of the Mark Johnson Show for 16 years on WDEV, 25 years overall. Mark, thank you so much for your time at the station and your time this morning.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The Champlain Valley is rich in history, and there's an organization that makes sure we are aware of it and that we celebrate it with events and opportunities to learn what has happened in this area long before any of us listening arrived here. This can range from the Native Americans who lived here, the activities during the American Revolution, the efforts to give women the right to vote, or steps to make our water clean. The organization is the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership. Joining us now to let us know about their work is their assistant director, Jim Brangen. Jim, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great having you. Listeners, to speak with Jim about the heritage of this region, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jim, what is the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership?
Well, the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership is one of 55 National Heritage Areas in the United States. Now, a National Heritage Area is a special designation that can only come through Congress. It's a program that's managed by the National Park Service, and here it's locally managed by the Lake Champlain Basin Program.
So is it overseen by the federal government?
No, it's not. We receive our funding from the federal government, and we do have to do some reporting to the feds. But the local decisions are all made by the Lake Champlain Basin Program Steering Committee. So it's folks from Vermont, New York, and Quebec working together to not only work on Lake Champlain's issues, but also to help us with creating stronger recreation programs and new initiatives around cultural heritage.
So what is the partnership's mission, Jim?
Well, basically our mission is to work with our partners, and we're the only National Heritage Area that has partnership in its title, and it's a title we take seriously. So our mission is to help elevate our partners who work in the cultural heritage field, the recreation field, and the educational field, to have people get a better understanding of our rich past and apply those lessons to today. That's one of the really neat things we have through the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership is an opportunity to reflect on the past and aim towards the future. So we do that through our three interpretive themes. The first is the making of nations. Of course, you touched on this a little bit in your introduction. And that theme focuses in on how our governments have evolved, how our people have lived here. So, for example, the Abenaki people were here long before the Europeans, the Mohawks on the other side of the lake, the Mohegans to the south of us during the colonization period. This was New France, New Netherlands to the south, and, of course, we've got New England and New York. And, of course, the American Revolution and the War of 1812, where this was a major conduit for invasion. And the reason why it was such an important route was because it's a strong commercial route, which helps us with the our second interpretive theme, which is the corridor of commerce. So just after the glaciers receded 10,000 years ago, people were using these waterways for trade. And we still use it today. Of course, there's a great recreation component to our economy here now, but the lake was used as a major highway between, say, 1823 when the Champlain Canal opened all the way until the past few decades when there are still oil barges going on it. And then, of course, there's the third interpretive theme, which is the conservation and community interpretive theme, and that focuses in on the human interaction with the landscape. And the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership has a really unique landscape. One of the components, one of the requirements, I should say, to become a National Heritage Area is to have a nationally important story, and, of course, we have three. It could be argued we have many more than that. And we have a landscape that can help tell that story. And of course, if you wandered around the hills of Vermont, you can see the remnants of the sheep farming era. You can see the stone walls in the woods, and you can also see cellar holes in places where farming didn't take hold. But you can also wander around in Vermont and find farmers markets and different types of agriculture that are in use today. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, what makes us special.
Now, you have something called the Passport Stamp Program. Tell us about that, Jim.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Rick. The National Park Service has a Passport Stamp Program. And it is an unbelievably popular program for visitors to our national parks. People will go into visitor centers from Glacier down to the Everglades just to get their passport stamp. And so we decided it would be a great opportunity for us to showcase the various components of our heritage area. So there are 11 locations here in Vermont, New York. And in Vermont, it ranges from the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge up in Swanton, all the way down to the American Museum of Fly Fishing in Bennington County in Manchester. And so it's a great way for people to go to these special places and learn about them. We basically have one in each of the counties for the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership. We could expand it to hundreds of these passport stamp locations, but we decided to keep it manageable. And if people do get all 11 stamps, they're eligible to get a commemorative coin, depending on what interpretive theme we're focused on that year.
What was the theme this year?
This year was actually a combination. This year, the focus was on Prohibition. We're dealing with the 100th anniversary of the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution. So we had a real focus on that. And in along with that, we also had a sort of a redo for the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. So it was an interesting and challenging summer for all, as was last summer. But it's just been amazing watching our partners really be able to overcome and adapt the obstacles that the pandemic brought forward. So the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership developed a series of interpretive displays for the suffrage movement, and those are displayed at the Coolidge Homestead down in Plymouth, and then they were transported all over the valley. In fact, you can still go see them if you head over to Plattsburgh, to the Plattsburgh Mall there. They're being displayed indoors. So if any of your listeners are part of an organization and like to display them, I'd love to share that.
Mm. Now, Jim, I got to tell you, I just had this zoinks moment because I never realized that Prohibition and women's right to vote were in succession 18th, 19th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. So you have taught me something brand new, should have known probably before, but thank you for that bit of information.
No problem. The governor of Vermont refused to convene the legislature in 1920 because he right. was not a dry governor. He was not in favor of prohibition. So Vermont was not the final state to ratify the 19th Amendment. That was Tennessee.
All right. Now, how about the American Revolution anniversary or anniversaries? I think we have something coming up very soon.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very few things we love more than anniversaries at the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership.
Good.
So we are gearing up for the revolution, the 250th, the semi-quincentennial. Your listeners are going to have to learn that word. The governor of Vermont has established a commission. It's chaired by Laura Treishman, who's the Vermont State Historic Preservation Officer and heads up the Division for Historic Preservation. And she's got a great team on the commission. If I do say so myself, I'm the vice chair. But beyond that, there's just a wealth of talent there. And the group is working to identify how do we get the word out, which has been challenging the past 18 months or so, and which direction we should be going in. So we're just at the beginning phases of many people to the table, so to speak, to give us their thoughts on how we should be marking this special event. On a personal note, I really became engaged in American history during the bicentennial. I was a little guy at the time, and my folks took me all over New England and showed me these Revolutionary War sites, and I got hooked. So this is a great opportunity for me to give back because of the richness that I received during the bicentennial. And I'm hoping that there's young people out there that'll feel the same way in the 250th.
I've got Jim Brangen of the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership here until 11 o'clock. Listeners, if you'd like to speak with Jim, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I get so very excited about learning about the interesting Vermonters we have all around us, but I also love getting to hear about the rich history that this area has. At dinner the other night, I learned about something called Carleton's Prize. Look it up. Fascinating. Joining me to talk about the group that works hard to preserve and share the history of the Champlain Valley is Jim Brangen. He's the Assistant Director of the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership. To join the conversation, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jim, you know that one, Carleton's Prize?
I sure do. Your listeners should certainly look it up. That's I love the little tip there. That's one of the elements of interpretation. We do a lot of interpretation at the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership, and the idea is you want to get people thinking about things and looking them up on their own.
That's brilliant. Now, I understand you have some grants that will be awarded in 2023, but the process is beginning now. So tell us about this grant program.
Yeah, we have a rather extensive timeline when it comes to our grants program. I'll just say that since 2008, the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership has awarded more than 215 grants totaling $1.5 million. Wow. It's a pretty impressive number. What's even more impressive is the match that we've been able to generate. This is the in-kind contributions and the materials that our partners bring to the table. And that totals $2.5 million. So this is, we've been able to invest, working with our partners, $4 million into the region, into our history and our culture and our recreation opportunities. So I'm pretty proud of that. I'm also proud of the grants process that we have. It's, like I said, it's quite lengthy, but it does work well for us. So in August, we invited organizations and communities to submit pre-proposals for grants. And those pre-proposals were reviewed and ranked, and 25 of them have been invited to submit full proposals for grants. So we typically give out about $200,000 a year in funding to about 20 different grants programs, grant recipients. And, those range from everything from most recently we helped fund the Vermont African American Heritage Trail Guide, working with ALANA and the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation and the Vermont Department of Tourism. So that drives people to different sites in Vermont that reflect the African American heritage here in the state. And since we're a bi-state international organization, there's a few sites in New York as well. Next year would be a really good opportunity for your listeners, if they're members of a community that want to focus on any of our five categories, they can start in with a pre-proposal. This year it's a little too late, but next year there will be time. We offer five different grants, as I said. The first would be an interpretive theme grant, and that is one of those three themes I mentioned earlier, the making of nations, the corridor of commerce and conservation and community. And so each year we focus on one of them. So last year it was making of nations with the women's suffrage amendment. This year was the corridor of commerce with prohibition. There was a lot of smuggling going on along the border there. And next year it will be the conservation and community interpretive theme, which is the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. So we really tried to do our best to touch all the bases and build as many partnerships as possible. And so those grants that will be going through the full proposal process will be awarded in April, and they will start work on October 1st of 2023. Like I said, it's a long process, but it's a sound one, and we've been using it for years.
Nice. Now, you do have a lot of programs. We're not going to get to all of them, but I want to tell us about Bridge Quest.
BridgeQuest. Yeah, that's a fun project. If well, my dog wants to be on the radio too, excuse me.
That's all right.
So the BridgeQuest, if you go down to the new Champlain Bridge, I guess I shouldn't call it new. It's been open for 10 years now. When that bridge was opened, the landscape sort of changed a bit. It really became a regional destination. In fact, if you go down to Crown Point State Historic Site in New York, right at the foot of the bridge on the New York side, anytime there's people out there walking, picnicking, there's joggers. There's all sorts of activities to have down there. I would say, you know, foot by foot, that is probably that region, mm-hmm. Crown Point and Chimney Point, are probably the most historically significant acres in the Champlain Valley. I'm sure there's a historian out there that wouldn't mind arguing with me on that one, but there's a great opportunity there for people to go out and they can follow the quest. And the quest is basically some simple riddles, and it takes you to all of the significant sites there. So it'll take you to the Champlain Memorial Lighthouse, where you mm-hmm. count the animals sculpted into the sculpture there. It'll take you over to the fort at Crown Point. It will take you to Chimney Point. It will take you down to the water itself on the bridge as well. So once you answer all of those riddles, and it's relatively easy, you can turn that into the Lake Champlain Visitor Center, and they will give you a Bridge Quest Challenge coin. So if you have a nice day and the visitor center is open, go ahead and grab one of those and check it out. Bring your friends and family. It's a really neat thing to do. It'll take about 3 hours to do total.
And again, Jim, allow me to tease our listeners. I'm not going to tell them where it is, but there is a bust by Rodin right there. And I still can't believe that we have it right there on the shore of Lake Champlain. Really outstanding. All right, Jim, give us another hidden gem, maybe lesser-known spot in the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership area that you just love for people to visit.
Oh, boy, a lesser-known spot? Boy, that's a tough one. Let's see here. Do you want it on Vermont or New York?
Either one.
Okay. I'll tell you one that I've been remiss in visiting for a while and got back out to just last year was Mount Independence State Historic
yep.
Park.
It
is a phenomenal place. It's a bit out of the way, but it was great during the pandemic because they've got miles and miles of hiking trails. They've got interpretation. It's got some of the most beautiful views of the Champlain Valley. That's definitely one.
It's got the, you know, bateau, the inverted bateau as the roof of the center there, which is really neat. At one point, the bridge, there was a bridge that was across, right, to the fort on the opposite side. So really interesting history there. All right, you got 1 minute for one more, Jim.
Okay. Well, I would have to say that if you're looking for good sweeping vistas, you should either ride out the island line, the rail trail from Burlington up to the islands
mm-hmm.
On your bike, or even you can park in South Hero and head down to the causeway there. And I think, like, it's one of the most beautiful views in America. Because you can get out there and the greens are on your left-hand side, the Adirondacks are over on your right-hand side, and you can look all the way down Lake Champlain. Yeah. If you find a beautiful day this winter, that'd be a great opportunity to check that place out.
A-plus. You got it. You nailed it. Jim Brangen is the Assistant Director of the Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership. You can learn all about them at ChamplainValleyNHP.org. Jim, thanks for sharing all this great information with us this morning.
My pleasure, Rick, and thank you to DEV for having me.
Oh, absolutely. All right, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com, and it is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.
This is WDEV, Vermont's news station, owned and operated by the Radio Vermont Group. From the top of Sugar Bush, 96.1 FM, WDEV Warren in Waitsfield, 96.5 W243 Berry, 98.3 W252 CU Montpelier, along with our founding station, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier, streaming at WDEVradio.com.